you know, one of the observations I have is that there's a lot of buzz around moving to cloud, and you see quite a few startup companies that are born on cloud, kind of, well, I'll just say doing it right. But then I also see a lot of existing companies who expect to derive value from the cloud, but they don't fully understand what that means. And effectively, they're just picking up existing on-premise workloads, migrating them to the cloud. And so, I mean, there's still some value in that. Like, the average company can't run a data center as securely and as in an available a manner as a cloud provider can. It's just, there's an economy of scale that most companies can't match there. But that's not really where a lot of the value is.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
Everybody, my guest today is Jerry Bell. Jerry's a veteran IT leader and the host of the Defensive Security Podcast. So he's about 260 episodes ahead of me in terms of podcasting experience. He and his co-host, Andy Khaled, provide insights and commentary what's going on in the world of cyber and IT security. In his day job, Jerry has held leadership roles in IT and IT security for I think close to 30 years now. Today, Jerry's the CISO of IBM's cloud division. And what it takes to run IT at cloud scale effectively and securely, that's what we'll talk about in today's episode. Jerry, I'm thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. Maybe to get us started, tell us just a little bit about yourself. How did you get to where you are today?
It's a fairly long and convoluted story. It involves a whole lot of luck. I kind of seem to be in the right place at the right time in a lot of ways. But early on, I took a couple of very difficult jobs with small companies that I think provided me a lot of context and knowledge that I still actually use to this day. It was kind of a one man IT shop for many years, and that taught me a lot. That I things I still use today.
Great. So, how did you get into podcasting about IT security? I mean, it's your job, so you know a lot about it. But what motivated you to do this?
It's a great question. I've now been doing this for about 10 years. About 10 years ago, I found podcasting. I hadn't really been terribly interested in it. And I started listening to some podcasts, and a lot of the security podcasts at the time were either kind of like general news, or they were very red team focused. And as somebody in more of a blue team role, this was, by the way, at the time of things like the Aurora attack and lots of other, the APT1 report and so on. It occurred to me that like there was a big missed opportunity for a blue team to actually like talk about and think about and share knowledge about what's happening out in the world, what can companies do to defend themselves. And for me personally, it kind of forced me to stay in touch with what's going on. And it forced me to continually think about what is happening. Like, why did these bad things happen to these companies? And if I were in their shoes, what could I have done to avoid that?
And we'll talk about some of that.
So that's the point of my show. We talk about topical news stories, but in general, the focus of that is to look at, you know, what from a breach standpoint, what's happened recently, what do we think happened, and what could we do to prevent that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's some really good stuff on there. So for everybody who's interested in IT security, it's definitely worth listening to these episodes. I haven't gotten through all 267 or so yet, but there are quite a few very interesting ones, and I learned a ton, definitely. Now, that is your side hustle, so to speak. Your day job, what's your role? I mean, everybody kind of has an idea of what a CISO does. Maybe that's completely wrong, but I guess everybody might have an idea. And yeah, your team at IBM, what do you do?
Oh, it's also a good question. It is very interesting. A lot of CISO roles are very situation dependent on companies. And one thing you find in a large company like where I'm at is, especially from company to company, the division of responsibilities is a bit different. So in my case, I'm responsible for the security of our cloud, the services we provide under the cloud banner, right? So, you know, our infrastructure as a service, our platform as a service, you know, various database services and so on. So, you know, I have teams of incident responders, penetration testers, security architects. Our job is to make sure that, you know, we are compliant with different laws and regulations, and that when we release new services out to the market, that, you know, they've passed through you know, some pretty rigorous security examinations, both from a pen testing, but also kind of a security design threat modeling review.
All right. Yeah. You mentioned, obviously everybody knows IBM. It's a huge organization. Within IBM, the cloud division, give us an idea how many people work sort of in the cloud division.
So it's, I don't know. We recently spun off a pretty large part of IBM into a separate company called Kyndryl. That was the managed services part of our business. And so as a percentage, I'm not entirely sure what we're at today, but you know, it's several thousand employees, and you know, several billion dollars in revenue. I won't go any more specific than that.
That's totally fine. It's a very sizable business. When it comes to cloud services. All right. Let's get to brass tacks and maybe start with something a bit provocative. You don't trust IT people. And I assume you don't want to offend anyone. So can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. I will say it's not necessarily that I don't trust IT people. It's that I don't trust them any more than any other person. Because at the end of the day, IT people are people. I have worked in IT for a very long time. This is actually 30 years for me. And one of the, in a variety of different organizations, and I've had experience interacting with many, many more organizations. And one of the common themes I see is that IT people and IT security too, like myself included, tend to occupy a trusted position. You know, we we view ourselves as not the problem, right? We are the solution. We are not the problem. It is those darn users who keep clicking on the wrong attachments and the wrong emails, and they're the ones who are hosing things up. But the, you know, the reality is, in my experience, is that, you know, IT people and security people are not different, but except for one fact, we often have elevated access, which is a risk, right? It's a risk that needs to be managed, just like any other risk. And so when I say that I don't trust IT people, it means that we also need to make sure that we're designing security controls appropriate to manage that risk, you know, that IT people pose. Again, not that they're bad people, but if you look at what happens in the industry from an adversary perspective, a lot of the success of the more advanced threats, more destructive threats, tends to rely on compromising accounts with privileges, which is typically your IT people. So
definitely,
it is a prudent step to wrap more control, my view, even more control around unprivileged than on IT people than on unprivileged people.
Yeah, definitely. One other aspect of this, I think, and you mentioned this on your podcast several times, is that, you know, everybody in IT operations would significantly benefit from having usually more exposure to red teaming and to pen testing techniques and things like that. What would they gain from that? Just better awareness?
For one, better awareness. I can best answer that with some stories, right? For many years, I was responsible for incident response in a pretty large organization. And on a bunch of occasions, was working with third-party clients who had been recently hacked. And it was a very common experience for me to have discussions with the IT teams up to the CIO of those affected organizations who had really no understanding that what happened could happen. They fundamentally didn't understand that their systems, the systems they designed and managed, could be abused in that manner. Like, they didn't understand how those things could progress and happen in their environment. So when I say that, it's because I think a lot of times IT people think about the way things are designed to work, but the bad guys, the adversaries, are thinking about the ways things actually work, which are oftentimes not the intended function. And so that's how we end up with vulnerabilities and, you know, kind of this, the normal stuff we see happening around the world. If my view is, if we had particularly architects, to some extent developers, who had a deeper understanding of these adversarial techniques, and they had that in the back of their mind as they're designing and operating things, my view at least is we would do things differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is exactly what happened, for example, with Log4j, and I think also a lot of other vulnerabilities that, you know, it worked as designed, but you could use it for things that were not what it was intended for.
Exactly. You see that quite often. Log4j, good example. Many, many, many more examples.
Yeah, definitely. Now, besides security, IT teams are continuously faced with a lot of different challenges. We're in the middle of a completely hybrid world. You know, you have your on-prem stuff, you have your public clouds, you have your private cloud, infrastructure sitting and systems sitting in all kinds of various places. in the conversation that we had prior to this, you mentioned that, you know, many IT operations and also DevOps teams are, you know, are not where you think they should be when it comes to designing for and running things in the cloud. What are they missing?
Also a great question. So I in my role, I get to see quite a lot of what goes right and what goes wrong. One of the observations I have is that there's a lot of buzz around moving to cloud, and you see quite a few startup companies that are born on cloud, kind of, well, I'll just say doing it right. But then I also see a lot of existing companies who expect to derive value from the cloud, but they don't fully understand what that means. And effectively, they're just picking up existing on-premise workloads and migrating them to the cloud. And so, I mean, there's still some value in that. Like the average company can't run a data center as securely and as in an available manner as a cloud provider can. It's just, there's an economy of scale that most companies can't match there. But that's not real where a lot of the value is. A lot of the value is in actually leveraging, you know, the full benefit of cloud and, you know, the orchestration and whatnot. So when I say that, I see some of the legacy IT practices being carried into cloud with a misunderstanding of roles and responsibilities, and also the protection, you know, the protection layer, right? When you operate in cloud, a lot of times there's not much between your workloads and the internet. Whereas in a traditional environment, a lot of times, you know, you have multiple levels of firewalls and address translation and on and on and on. It doesn't necessarily exist in cloud. And it's also, by the way, super simple to spin up cloud resources. Like in a lot of, especially larger organizations that are used to on-prem operations, like if you ordered a server, it would could take weeks, days or weeks. But now in the cloud world, like seconds.
It's a line of code.
Yeah. It's a line. Exactly. It's a line of code. And if you're not, if you don't have the right governance and the right guardrails around how those things get provisioned and secured, it's really easy for IT people to do the wrong thing, set up things in an insecure manner, and then they get compromised, ransomware, you know, variety of bad things can happen. There's just a lot of different some of the same threats, right, that exist in on-prem environments, but some new things, like, you know, the fact that you have this concept of a control plane that can be accessed and administered using API keys, and, you know, a lot of focus these days on giving back to open source and whatnot, and you know, it's been a pervasive problem in the industry where developers will unknowingly, not intentionally, check in passwords and check in API keys into their code that they contribute to public repos. And the adversaries, by the way, have gotten super adept at mining for that stuff, like to the point where the time it takes, we were playing with this, right? It takes about 3 hours from the time you check in an API key until the time someone is trying to use it to do something bad.
Wow. That's really fast. So there's two ways that we could take this answer that you just gave me. So one is sort of, you mentioned sort of cloud native versus your classic lift and shift, and what does, you know, what's the one, what's the other. The other thing you mentioned is roles and responsibilities and governance, sort of the organizational aspect of things. And I want to focus on that first. Maybe we'll come back to the other one down the road. So you know, there used to be like an IT team in a company. And today, you know, the more complex the infrastructure gets and hybrid and everything. And, you know, as software is eating the world as well, you know, these roles get very much differentiated. You have your IT ops teams, you have DevOps, you have, you know, cloud infrastructure teams, you have your application developers that also do some infrastructure things. What lessons have you learned over sort of the last 30 years as to what works and what maybe doesn't work from an organizational view, if you want to be able to run the cloud at scale?
There's some significant differences, especially when you think about traditional roles in IT, like network teams and security teams and ops teams and dev teams, all being kind of distinct teams. All that stuff in cloud is to some extent smashed together. And so, you know, you don't have necessarily an ops team that is, again, different than a dev team. And you know, we don't have in many respects, you don't have like the normal traditional system administrator role who is out there provisioning systems and, you know, configuring things and then handing the keys off to somebody else. That doesn't happen. Like, all of that stuff is now orchestrated in code. Again, if you're doing it kind of in the cloud native way, which is much more aligned with, with a developer type mindset. And so, you know, the shift that I'm seeing is taking those traditional network and security and sysadmin and ops roles, and they're becoming much more like a developer, because again, the way that they're interacting with the environment is kind of through configurations and code, not through interacting with systems and logging into firewalls and making firewall rule changes. It's all orchestrated now. Mm-hmm. And that requires a bit different talent set. But then also, you know, beyond that, it's how do you govern that? So how do you know that when those things are now all aspects of code, right? Terraform scripts, what have you? How do you know that your infrastructure as code is designed and written in a secure manner? So I mean, there's a whole new kind of a whole new approach, but it has like strong echoes to what we've seen in the past. It's just in a very different package now.
Got it. Yeah. Now, let's go from sort of abstractly talking about running things in the cloud in general to you and your company. In the conversation we had leading up to this, you had a interesting and surprising to me answer to the question about what your biggest challenge is when it comes to operating IBM's cloud infrastructure efficiently and securely. What is it?
It's the scale, right? It is operating at scale. It's the reality that, you know, we occupy a fairly unique, not completely unique, obviously, but a narrow market, right? There aren't a lot of hardware and software vendors, security vendors in particular, that make things that operate at cloud scale. And one of the harsh realities of being in the cloud business is it's all about scale. It, you know, it is all about automation. It is all about orchestration, even kind of below the line in, you know, in cloud. Obviously, like, orchestration and automation is kind of the promise of cloud, why you would want to be there. But from a below the line perspective, you know, to be competitive, you have a fleet of tens or hundreds of thousands of systems, tens of thousands of network devices. These all have to be managed. They have to be patched. They have to be, you know, configured. We have to make sure that they're secure. We have to know when and if something bad happens. Like, we have to be able to identify that really fast. And you know, that when you have, you know, a huge environment split across dozens of data centers, you know, with, again, with these hundreds of thousands or millions of systems, it takes a different set of tools than typically are available to kind of the mainstream company. So that, I would say, is one of our big challenges. Like, we want to do certain things, you know, security things, but our the options, the commercial options available to us to satisfy that are often pretty limited.
So how do you approach this? Do you just also build your own stuff? I mean, Google famously built Borgmon, which then, you know, later became Prometheus and now is open source, a really great project. That's definitely, or probably, I'm guessing, one thing that you're doing, right? Well,
there is a lot of self-invented tools, I will say that. There's a lot of chaining together in maybe not intended ways, you know, existing tools, open source tools, commercial tools. It requires a lot of creativity in how to solve some of these security challenges at that scale. So there isn't one answer to that, I guess, but, you know, certainly we do create our own tools. You know, being part of IBM, we're kind of in an interesting space that we have, like, a lot of capabilities that other companies don't necessarily have. Like, we own QRadar, and we own Instana, and we own Red Hat, and we own, you know, so we have some capabilities that we can draw on, but it still requires a lot of innovation.
Makes sense. Another thing you mentioned, and if I'm to believe my wife, who's a regulations expert in the automotive industry, it requires a lot of creativity, is solving the regulation puzzle. And we talked briefly about this, that this actually has a large and growing effect on how you run and can run your business.
That's the other major challenge for being a global cloud provider is what's happening in the regulation space. You know, we saw, I would say, like, a big sea change in regulations with the GDPR back a couple of years ago. You know, that was kind of like, that sucked the air out of the room, because up to that point, you know, there were lots of data privacy regulations, but, like, that one was the first one that had real teeth. That got people to stand up and take note. And so now you see a lot of both for the purpose of protecting their citizens' personal data, but more recently, you know, especially with what's been happening in cyber war and you know, whatnot, a lot of countries are starting to look at, you know, cloud providers and some of the critical infrastructure that might operate on top of cloud providers as they need to more carefully regulate that. And so what is emerging, what I see emerging, is this kind of tapestry of incompatible regulations. Now, it's not a problem yet, but, like, you can kind of look at the horizon and see, like, if we continue on the trend line that we're on, it's going to be very difficult, perhaps impossible, to operate, you know, one global cloud service and say that you comply with like the GDPR and you comply with the new Australia Security of Critical Infrastructure Act and you comply with, you know, the LGPD down in Brazil and so on. So as time goes on, a lot of countries, you know, they tend to think that they're the best and brightest and smartest, and so they're creating what they believe is needed to protect their citizens and their economy and their, you know, the lifestyles of their citizens. And I'm not saying, by the way, that they're necessarily wrong. Like that's something that only they can really decide. But as a global company and a global cloud provider, you know, the direction we're headed in, I fear, is going to make it very difficult to do business, the way that we're doing it today. So, you know, we're already starting to see some fragmentation. You know, different cloud providers are starting to look at what I'll call franchise models.
It makes it also challenging from a sort of your customer's perspective.
Yes.
Because, you know, you want to offer a certain service on a global scale. You know, let's say you're a car manufacturer and you want to provide infotainment services in your car. Well, these might need to sort of work very differently. Let's say if you're in Australia or you're in China or you're in Germany or the US, which has its own set of challenges.
Yeah, there's many, many reasons that you would want a global cloud provider, right? Exactly like you said, but you could think about other use cases, content delivery networks. Like you want those to be, you know, kind of close to where your customers and end users are. And, you know, a way you do that is by using a global provider, whether that's, you know, like IBM or AWS or Akamai or Cloudflare or, you know, somebody like that that has a global footprint. That's, my view, going to become more and more challenging as time goes on, unless we start to see some rationalization of how these laws are being written. And by the way, I'm not trying to be defeatist. I hope that, you know, that we start to see some of that harmonization, but not seeing it yet.
Yeah. And I mean, there are also always sort of very, let's not kid ourselves, there's very strong, sometimes sort of economic policy motives that are behind some of these regulations 100%. To benefit your own industry versus, you know, those from whatever other region of the world, and make it more difficult for them. So that's an aspect that, you know, speaks against harmonization and rationalization, as you said.
Correct.
So changing subjects just a little bit, or actually quite a bit, but you know, we do monitoring. We provide open source and enterprise monitoring tools. And we've mentioned one or two or three monitoring tools in this conversation. I know this is a very broad question, but sort of coming back to you know, what you do and operating your cloud infrastructure, you know, what role does or should maybe monitoring and observability play in security? Because many times, you know, customers ask me, it's like, you know, can your monitoring tool do X, Y, Z? And so, well, sometimes the answer is yes, but that's not really what it's designed to do. It has some security aspects, but it's not a security tool, but it has a role to play. What is that role in your perspective?
Well, obviously, hopefully it's fairly apparent that monitoring is a critical security function. I mean, let's just throw that out there right out of the gate. You know, you don't have a security operations center without the ability to monitor your environment. And without that ability, you don't know, you just don't have situational awareness. So I think it's absolutely critical. Where I think we have as an industry some room to grow is in, you know, kind of the differentiation between traditional monitoring and what we think about now as observability. Like I think that we're pretty nascent, pretty new, pretty underexplored, I guess, when we think about using that observability concept for security purposes. Because you can think about, you know, as we continue to decompose our our architectures and our applications to be more cloud native, you know, a lot of that observability is around monitoring for where is the problem, where is the lag, the delay coming from, you know, it's and orchestrating a response to that. But it's not hard to think about extending that to, why did that server suddenly spike to 100% CPU? Is it mining cryptocurrency? And if it is, well, that's,
we've actually had instances of that. Sorry that I'm interrupting you, but with customers where, you know, when we help them implement their monitoring, we suddenly found, they found with their help, a few servers that had been used for exactly that. And now I won't get into the details whether this was intentional by somebody on the inside or somebody from the outside. But yes, we've had exactly that happen. And I think more than once, actually.
It is. I will say, just kind of going back to an earlier comment, like from a cloud attack perspective, one of the most common types of attacks I see against customer workloads is crypto mining. So I'm not surprised to hear that in the least. But I think where we have a lot of opportunity ahead of us is applying that concept of observability in novel ways to, you know, to monitor and get an early indication of security, you know, events happening in different components that might, you know, again, if we kind of carry it out to its logical extreme, an AI ops style concept applied to security, not just not just like IT operations. So I think monitoring is absolutely critical today. I mean, like it is so fundamental that it's hard to even overstate how important that is. But I think as an industry, like, we have a lot more growing to do with some of the new capabilities that, you know, the tooling and transformation of how we're architecting our environments.
All right. There's one more topic that I wanted to talk to you about.
Sure.
As you know, we're an open source company. You've mentioned you use open source tools. When it comes to sort of security and open source, there seem to be two camps. There's the one camp that says, well, the only thing that's truly secure is open source, because you can look at the source code and see what's going on. And then there's those people that say, well, you know, open source projects, there's no real accountability. There's less resources than, you know, a company like that you know, makes money on this has. Not to say that open source companies can't make money, but there are open source projects that don't. And all, you know, lower resources, all that. And there are examples of this. I'm pretty sure you've heard about this book, or maybe you've read it. This is How They Tell Me the World Ends by Nicole Perlroth, which is really great. I just recently read it. Our CEO recommended it to me. And there's this aspect about OpenSSL, and, you know, which is one of the cornerstones of security on the internet. And it was basically maintained by a single engineer on, you know, a few thousand bucks in donations from well-intentioned individuals. What are your thoughts on that? What can sort of we as an industry do to reap the benefits of open source? Because I'm convinced, you know, open source as a concept is great, but at the same time, sort of alleviate some of the challenges that this brings with it.
Wow. This is such a big question that the industry is dealing with right now. I will say, you know, I forget if it was Torvalds or Eric Raymond that said it, you know, the concept that all bugs are shallow with enough eyes.
I think it was the latter. It wasn't Torvalds.
Okay. I'm getting old. So one of the problems of getting old is memory. So, you know, what I see when I look at things that have, like the example of OpenSSL, right? That's not the only instance. I mean, Log4j. We talked about Log4j. There's been a host of OpenSSL issues to the point now where most companies have kind of gone a different way, or many companies have kind of gone a different way away from OpenSSL to some of their own forks. I think the challenge we have right now is it's open source has kind of become a victim of its own success. There's you know, if you rewind the clock, you know, 20 years ago, when I first started playing with open source, or 25 years ago, there wasn't a lot out there, right? It was fairly containable. And it was a bit of a hobbyist thing. We were all coding, you know, we were all coders and whatnot. But these days, like it's changed quite a bit. There's a lot more consumers than there are coders. And we are seeing, you know, and the NPM debacle is a great example. Like NPM has been a bit of a mess over the past year or so. Not that it's a bad ecosystem, but it has some like systemic problems where you have a person who is administering or is the owner of a particular code base that becomes wildly popular, right? And then it becomes integrated into many, 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 many different things. And then that person decides, well, I really don't like what's going on in Ukraine, which I personally don't agree with either. But they, you know, they put in, they inject a file cryptor into that, and so now you have this, you know, you have someone who is responsible for that piece of code actually doing something malicious. Let alone kind of the accidental introduction of vulnerabilities like we saw with OpenSSL. So I think as an industry, we have to get to a point where we are injecting trust back into open source. And I don't know if that means like we're going to end up with some kind of stratified view of open source. Like we have the untrusted Wild West, and we have the kind of trusted middle band, and then we have the highly trusted lower band that might maybe is overseen by, I was going to say the Apache Foundation, but that they've had some issues too. But, you know, maybe the Linux Foundation or some responsible focused application of people to perform security code reviews and you know, proactive assessments and hygiene assessments like you would expect maybe in a closed source application on a subset at least of kind of core trusted open source. But I think even that is kind of flawed because it's so pervasive and so simple to include, you know, componentry from all across the ecosystem. So I candidly don't have a great solution to this beyond saying like what we do today doesn't work and it's getting worse.
Yeah, I like what you said. It's become a victim of its own success. I think there's a lot of truth in that. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And I know the Cloud Native Foundation and others are coming up with these kind of programs, you know, to better fund projects, to do code reviews, security reviews, these kind of things. That's probably going to be an answer or part of an answer to the problem, but it's also not a panacea. It won't solve everything. I agree right. with you there. All right. Maybe to, you know, we're on the home stretch to wrap things up. We have a few sort of rapid fire questions we ask every guest, some a little bit tongue in cheek. How old were you when you first started with computers?
10.
10. And how old were you when you broke your first computer?
10 and a half.
What did you do? Do you remember?
I remember I broke a tape drive.
Okay.
This was during the days. I think my first computer was a VIC-20 with a Commodore VIC-20 with a tape drive. And I'm pretty sure I broke the tape drive.
All right. The drive or the tape?
The drive.
Oh, okay. Okay. That was a bit more difficult to fix. Now we've talked about open source, we've talked about closed source, and there's probably no right answer to this question, but if you'd had to choose open source or closed source?
Neither.
All right. No. What's the third option?
I
Or you just don't want to choose?
They both have intractable problems. Like it annoys me to watch the fanboys behind each camp, right? You know, yet you have the diehard open source people who are convinced that closed source can never be secure. And then you have like this never ending onslaught of log4j, OpenSSL. I mean, like there's a lot, right? And then on the other side, you have the commercial closed source crowd, you know, throwing rocks at open source. And yet Microsoft for the last 20 years has been releasing a patch, you know, pretty important set of patches on a monthly basis, right? So neither side is harmless. Like there's issues all the way around. It's just the nature of the issues. You know, the one thing that you have on the closed source side is like you have contractual commitments, but like, you know, have those ever really accomplished anything? I don't know.
Hmm. All right. Now this is probably, I'm asking the wrong person for that because you own but IBM owns a Linux company, but obviously IBM and PCs have a close history with Windows as well. So the answer actually might be quite interesting is if you personally had to choose, would you choose Linux or Windows?
Windows on the desktop and Linux on the server.
That's actually, I think you're the second guest who chooses that combination. But yeah, makes sense. Yeah. Now I know the answer to this one. I would be very surprised if cloud or on-prem?
You know, it's fascinating. If you would ask me this question 10 years ago, it would have been very different than today. So I say cloud today. But again, 10 years ago, I would have had a different answer. I was at one point, hey, cloud is just somebody else's computer crowd.
Yeah.
But here I am.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, a lot has happened in the cloud and with the cloud over the last 10 years. So, and if you had to choose code or configure?
Code.
All right, good. Well, Jerry, these were our rapid fire questions. This has been a lot of fun and very insightful for me. And if you want to, you have the option to directly address our audience. You know, anything you're interested in, anyone can help you with, you're looking for. Besides, obviously, I already recommended your podcast, which is really great. And I recommend everybody listen to. Anything else?
So I will I'll put out a request. You know, if you are in a position to donate to the relief organizations for the people who have been displaced or affected by what's going on in the Ukraine, I would ask you to do that, please.
All right. That's something I can fully support. Definitely.
It's super. There's a comedian who did a bit of a sketch about how lately you wake up every day thinking like, what historic event that will be talked about for the next 500 years is going to happen today.
Yeah.
And so, just be safe, be kind to others. So I think that's it.
Yeah. Maybe just stay on that for a second. I mean, you're a global organization. Are you directly affected in Ukraine? Do you have people there, teams there?
We have or have had employees in every country that it's legal to do business in. And so, yeah, we have had employees, you know, affected in Ukraine. We've done, you know, obviously everything we can to help make sure that they're safe and that their families are taken care of. But, you know, obviously it's just a terrible situation, and nothing that we could do is really going to be enough.
Yeah. All right. If people want to, what's the best place to find you? LinkedIn is the Defensive Security Podcast page.
If you want to listen to the podcast, you can go just about every podcast place, but it's defensivesecurity.org. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm trying to be on Twitter a little bit more or less. I don't know yet, given what's recently happened.
Are you migrating to Mastodon?
Well, so interesting you mentioned that. For the past 5 years, I've actually run a Mastodon server.
Oh, okay.
The address there is infosec.exchange.
All right.
I will tell you, over the past 48 hours since that announcement, or maybe 72 hours, it has been an absolute chaotic flood of people.
That's interesting. I did not know that. That's a cool piece of info. People check that out as well, and we'll include links to everything in the show notes as customary. Jerry, I've had a lot of fun. This was super interesting. Thanks for making the time and answering my questions and being a guest.
You bet. Thank you for having me here. This was very fun.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe29, the CheckMK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.